Welcome everyone to the CALGASA conference call entitled Advancing Primary Prevention, Challenges and Opportunities for Working Within Service Delivery Organizations. Just as a reminder, this conference is being recorded. Now please, let us welcome our speaker for today, Mr. David Lee. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much and welcome to today's Prevention Connection web conference, Advancing Primary Prevention, Challenges and Opportunities for Working Within Service Delivery Organizations. And I see that we've got a lot of people from throughout the country, and you've been sharing your, I see on the in the text chat where you're from, so it's really great to see how many people are here. So I'd like to welcome you to today's session. I'm really excited to have this really important discussion that we are moving forward to. I do want to be able to let you know that Prevention Connection is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and that we do have a team of people that work on this, and that our main contacts would be myself, David Lee, or Chad Sniffen, and we're able to provide support for you in being able to do these programs. Prevent Connect has our website where you did sign up, and we have a wide variety of information. I encourage you to look throughout our website for information on prevention of violence against women. We have podcasts, online presentations. I'm also very excited about the Prevention Connection Wiki, which this is what the Wiki looks like. The Wiki is a user-generated website of people putting information specifically about violence against women prevention. And it's a way that we're collecting the wisdom of people in the field to be able to do our work. You also can sign up for our listserv. We have over 900 people who are talking about prevention of violence against women on our listserv discussion. It sometimes can be a heavy discussion, but a lot of people doing that. You also can sign up for our web conferences and our reading clubs, where we will be having articles that have been recently published and have small discussions of people around the country to talk about the implications for violence against women prevention. Also, archives of all the information is available on our website, so please check that out to learn more about that. I do want to highlight a few upcoming web conferences that will be coming up soon. In August, we'll be having a web conference on engaging bystanders in violence against women prevention. This is to be supporting the publication of a soon-to-be National Sexual Violence Resource Center publication on bystanders. And so we are going to be excited to have some great speakers for that. And then on September, Prevention Institute will be leading a web conference on culture and violence against women, looking at rap and other popular music genres and the relationships to violence against women prevention. So I hope you join us for those upcoming web conferences. I do want to talk briefly about how to be able to use our technology, that this is an exciting technology that we can do many things with. One of the things you can do is you can raise your hand, and if you look, there's a hand above my picture on the right-hand side of your computer, and can please everyone raise your hand. Great, I see people are starting. I only have, I've got 26 people. Keep on raising your hand. This is something that we will be asking you to do during our session, and it gives us a sense of some of the reaction. So go ahead, continue to raise your hand. If you haven't, it should be above, a little above my picture on the computer screen. Great. Well, thank you very much for being able to raise the hand, and that will be something that we can do throughout our web conference. And many of you are familiar with the text chat that we wrote down, that you've been writing down where you're from, and that's great to get a sense of who people are. And in our web conferences, people enjoy being able to write comments, ask questions, and connect and network with each other. We will post our text chat at the end of the session so people can be able to see information that's available. The box that you see is a little difficult to read, so one way to expand your text chat is there's a little box. I'm circling that box in the right-hand, upper right-hand corner of the chat box. And if you click that, it will open up the box to make it a little easier to read. So that's something that you might consider doing. Another feature that we have is what we call our is questions and answers, and that we can be able to ask you questions. And it should be opening up shortly. And what I want to do is ask a question. And so the first question I want to ask is, Have you attended a previous Prevention Connection web conference? Either yes, you have attended a previous one, or no, you have not. And that appears on your screen. And so go ahead and I haven't seen anyone answering yet. You answer it on the screen, not in the text chat, but actually in the screen. I see that we've got a bunch of people that are writing down that they have or haven't. So go ahead on the screen where it says, have you attended a previous web conference? Go ahead and keep on voting. We've got about 50% of the people have voted. And I see that many people are writing into the message. This is great to be able to get a sense of who our audience is and how your experience with this. I'm going to share the results with you just so you can get a sense that we had about 43% have attended a previous, about 31%, this is the first time. Welcome to Prevention Connection, and I believe the remaining 26% did not vote. So we will withdraw those results and just get a sense. The other piece I just want to get a little sense from you is if you can be able to describe your organization. What best describes your organization? And what I'm going to do is ask. Oh, I have to withdraw my question before I can do that. I've withdrawn my question, and now I'm going to pose the new question, which is, oh, that was the wrong question. I jumped ahead too early. That's, I'm going to ask this question here. And that question is, what describes your organization? Are you a domestic violence prevention agency? Are you a sexual assault prevention agency? Are you a public health department? Are you with education, a college or a university? Are you or some other? And go ahead and click on that, and I can see what people are doing. If you wrote other, go ahead and write down in the text chat what you are so we can get a little sense of who's in this audience. I see we have dual agencies, public health departments, and then I'm going to share domestic violence prevention. Someone said, I didn't see an arrow. You just have to click in the little circle. That's how you get the box. And we've got some dual agencies, child abuse prevention, that's great, and some counseling, family services I see here, and comprehensive victim services. I'm going to share the results with you all to get a sense of who our audience is. And as you can see, we have about 12% from domestic violence agencies, 20% from sexual assault agencies, 7% from public health, 7% from education, college or university, and 25% are other. I'm now going to withdraw that question, and I'm going to close the questions for all of you. So you will go back to our slides. Our next slide on slide 7 is I just want to be able to highlight that this, with this technology, you always can send a private text chat to us. If you have any questions about the technology, you can also call iLink's technical assistance at 800-799-4510. And if you have other information, you can call, and Chad is here to help you at CalCASA at 888-922-5227. I'm going to move to slide 8 and just highlight that we are in this presentation talking about violence against women. Our definition is very broad. We include domestic violence and sexual violence and look at violence across the lifespan. What we are doing at Prevention Connection is to focus on how to prevent violence before violence starts and to connect to other forms of violence. So that is the what we are seeking to be able to do here. On slide 9, I want to highlight some of our national other CDC-funded collaborative partners and their resources. That the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, the National Youth Violence Prevention Resource Center, and VAWNet. Prevention Connection is sponsored by the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in this web conference are not to represent the official views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. So I see a lot of people sending messages asking about sayings, which sexual assault nurse examiners. We actually are going to be talking about getting people from those types of programs involved in primary prevention today, looking at that service delivery question. So I am really pleased to be able to hand over the rest of our conversation to be led for now on from Prevention Institute, where we have Liz Waiters and Rachel Davis. And they will be leading our conversation with our guests, and many of you will get a chance to be able to participate. So why don't I hand it over to you, Liz and Rachel.
Great. Thanks, David. Hi, everybody. This is Liz Wheaton from the Institute. I'm a program director here, and I'm happy to be here with you again for yet another in this series of Prevention Connection Web Forum. And I'd like to introduce my co-host for today, Rachel Davis, who's our program manager here. No, sorry. A managing director here at Prevention Institute.
Hi, Liz. Thanks. And hi, everyone. I'm really happy to be here. I've been behind the scenes for a long time now on these forums, and it's nice to kind of be back here with you, Liz, and with all of you. And I'm very interested in what we're going to be talking about today. I think it's a really important issue, and that together we have a lot to learn. I've been working a lot on youth violence prevention, and I'm curious to hear some of the answers and solutions we get today, because I think that will also inform the broader field for preventing violence as well. So, hi, everyone.
This is great. We have a lot of people. Hopefully, we want to hear a lot from people who are members of Delta Sites, how they're putting this stuff together. We have a really exciting panel. And as you all know, preventing violence is an issue in terms of how we can do it before violence occurs. So what we're trying to do is put together a systematic and comprehensive approach to change community conditions and social norms that can help foster healthy environments and healthy behaviors that will in turn prevent violence against women from occurring in the first place.
So on slide 12, we have the spectrum of prevention. And if you look at that, you can see that there's a range of elements needed to mobilize the community to develop these comprehensive strategies to change environments and norms that are otherwise conducive to or tolerant of violence against women.
Exactly. And while we've been using this as a framework to think about the range of strategies that need to be in place to support community-wide systems or norms change, today, we also want to think of it as a framework for the range of strategies that might need to be in place within an organization to incorporate primary prevention successfully.
So as we explore today the ways in which primary prevention can be done within service delivery organizations and ask you about what's working or what might be needed, we're going to encourage you to be looking at these levels and using the spectrum as a framework to think about what might help advance these efforts more generally.
That's right. And so today we're going to be talking about the notion of practicing primary prevention from within a service delivery model. And as most of you would probably agree, there's a very strong and effective service delivery infrastructure in place. For example, through shelters and rape crisis centers and coalitions that are focused on advocacy for services.
And of course, there's also been an increasing emphasis on also doing primary prevention. And the resources have been allocated through this same delivery system for the most part. Frankly, as I'm sure everyone, you know, who's on this call today can attest to, there haven't been enough resources for either. And it's been challenging for organizations and the folks focused not only on intervention and services, but also on effective primary prevention.
Mm-hmm. And because of that, we thought it would be helpful to explore this in more depth to identify some of the milestones and to also identify implications for the field so that primary prevention can be better supported.
So let's start off with a show of hands. If you work within a service delivery organization with major responsibilities for victim services and services such as hotlines, shelters, referrals, raise your hand.
The hand to raise your hand, it would be above the picture of Liz and Rachel. Go ahead and do that.
The hand. We've about so far about almost 60 folks have raised their hands. So a lot of people. And so we're going to be learning from you, and we'll let you keep kind of raising those hands a little bit as we move forward. But certainly, we hope that not only today you'll get some tips for how to advance that more, but also you'll let us know and share with us what, you know, what you've been doing that's been working effectively.
Well, we're really looking forward to reading the text chat, and we're going to be opening the phone lines intermittently throughout this. So as you look at the next slide, here are our learning objectives for today. During the next 55 minutes or so, we're going to be discussing the challenges of adopting a primary prevention approach within service delivery organizations. We're going to describe ways in which service delivery organizations are engaging in a primary prevention approach to preventing violence against women. We're going to share strategies, and that means not only between our panelists, but also our audience, of what's been effective. And we're also going to brainstorm ways to work in partnership with service delivery organizations.
Okay, and now that I've figured out how to advance slides, I can put up the slide with the agenda. So as you can hopefully see on the screen, today we'll begin with a brief introduction of the topic and our four guest panelists, which will be followed by a facilitated discussion about how they're incorporating primary prevention. And then we'll open up the phone lines and text chat to give all of you more of a chance to ask questions and share what you've been doing. We'll end with an evaluation that we hope you'll take the time to complete, as those are very important for us in shaping these. And then finally, as usual, we'll be weaving in interaction and discussion throughout.
Exactly. So but before we get started, one of the things I'd really like to do is to thank all of you who submitted answers to the questions that were presented to you when you were registering for today's forum. And we were getting answers as far as not only throughout the country, but from people in other countries. We were getting answers to the questions as late as this morning. And I really want to thank all of you, because a lot of the responses that we received have helped shape today's forum and the questions that we're going to pose to our panelists as well.
Yeah, and as much as they've helped shape the forum, today's forum is a little different than other forums, because we're going to have much more of a dialogue and a conversation. We're putting some questions out there to explore and discuss together, and we're looking forward to an exciting and enlightening discussion with our panelists and all of you.
All right, so let's get started.
All right, so that brings us to slide 17, which is a service continuum. As we all know, violence against women results in physical, emotional, and physical harm, not only to women, but of course also to children, families, and entire communities. And while there's a critical need for services and responses to those who have been affected by violence against women, there's also a critical need to ensure that everything possible be done to prevent violence in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Now, primary prevention, as we've been talking about throughout the series, means taking action before the onset of symptoms. And as attention to primary prevention increases, associated funding requirements often dictate that service delivery organizations incorporate primary prevention into their practices.
Which means that as service delivery organizations continue to assist victims and their families and work to interrupt the cycle of violence, we hope that increasingly we're also asking what can be done to prevent violence against women before it occurs, and what's the role of service delivery organizations within that.
Mm-hmm. And on this continuum here, you see the slide describes the relationship between prevention, intervention, and treatment in terms of when approaches are applied.
So the prevention level is approaches taking place before the violence has occurred. Intervention is really immediate responses after or to ensure that kind of imminent violence doesn't occur. And on the treatment end of the continuum, we have victim services and perpetrator accountability programs, which represent longer-term responses after violence has occurred and promotes safety long-term as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, to get us right into today's topic, we want to start off with a few polling questions. So on the next slide, you'll see here, Rachel, thank you. Okay. The first question that we want to ask is, on the prevention, intervention, victim services continuum, what's the predominant focus of your organization? Is it on prevention, intervention, victim services, or all three equally?
And we're limited in how many options we can give you. So we realize we're sort of forcing what might be a false weighting,
right,
or a false answer.
And there are no in between.
Okay,
here.
So David's got
I see a lot of people are writing in the text chat all three equally, and then I notice that people are also voting from on your screen. You should see the question.
And if you've written all three equally or something in the text chat, if you can also just go ahead and put that into the check off the box on the polling question, that would be super.
Okay, should we share the answers?
Sure. Let's see what we came up with.
It looks like a third of the people do all three equally, and then 12% prevention, and then, you know, recognizing that those who are on a Prevention Connection call might not be representative of the field, but representative of those who are interested in prevention.
Right, but I think it'll be interesting to see how that might contrast with the next question,
mm-hmm.
Which is, on the same continuum, what is the predominant focus of your work, regardless of what the primary focus of your organization might be? So again, you have those options: prevention, intervention, victim services, continuum, all three equally. And we'll just give folks a little bit more time to get their answers in there.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised, though, to see that only 6% were in intervention, 6% in victim services.
Yeah, I think that David's point about participating in Prevention Connection might also be
good. Well, let me share the results of this question of who does the work here, because here we see that 37% of the people who are participating in this call predominant focus is on prevention. 14% are all 14 equally. I'm hearing a little bit of someone's voice, which is one of our guest speakers, so if you can be attentive. Thank you. So we have overall people are looking at prevention here.
Okay. Bring them with me tomorrow.
Great. So hopefully you'll have a lot to share with us about how you're doing prevention and how you've moved your organization into a direction that you can actually focus primarily on prevention. So on our next slide, slide 20, you'll see the prevention continuum, which describes the differences between primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. And at the primary prevention level, approaches take place before violence has occurred. Secondary prevention describes immediate responses after violence has occurred and is focused on the consequences of violence in the short term. And at the far end of the continuum, you have tertiary prevention, which consists of long-term responses, as Rachel said earlier, after violence to deal with the lasting consequences of violence.
So, you know, this might be a little bit redundant with the questions we just did, but we wanted to drill down a little bit more in terms of the prevention piece and kind of thinking about who might most likely be participating right now. And so what we want to do is bring up another polling question and look at this breakdown between the primary, secondary, and tertiary. So, David, do you want to go ahead and bring up that polling question?
This is the percentage.
This is what percentage of your organization's work is focused on primary prevention. And the primary is really, as we've been focused on in these forums, really the upfront community-wide norms change, systems change.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that polling question is coming up. The system seems to be a little slow.
Yeah, it should be on your screen, and people are starting to vote.
Great. So again, this is of your organization, not necessarily your focus, but your organization's focus.
Mm-hmm. And the emphasis, as Rachel said here, is on primary prevention.
I see a few people are writing in the text chat their organization is 100% focused on primary prevention.
Wow.
Some people are finding their screen is not advancing, and that we do, there's a little bit of, some people have slow connections. Sometimes your computer does occasionally freeze and you need to leave the meeting and then come back in.
Okay,
let's share the results of what we've got, because I think it's, while many people have written 100% in their in the text chat, we see a little different that the biggest response was 25% of the people responded that their organization puts between 25 and 50% of their focus on primary prevention. Another 19% was less than 25%, and only 8% of the people responding here said their organization is 100% focused on primary prevention, and there was also small numbers for B and C.
Okay. So So I think that's kind of interesting, about a quarter between 25 and 50% is a focus. But, you know, looking at primary prevention as an emphasis of, you know, up to 50%, that's pretty significant.
Yeah.
So let's go to the next one, and, mm-hmm. you know, you might see a pattern here, because now we want to hear what the focus of your work is, regardless of what the overall emphasis of the organization. So
right.
here the question, so David, have you posted it yet?
The question should be
posted. So we're asking, what percentage of your work is focused on primary prevention? And again, if you can put it into the polling question, that's great. Some people are having a hard time doing that and putting it in text chat, and that's great because we're able to save that and have an archive of people's responses.
Mm-hmm.
Won't be an exact scientific sampling since we won't know if there's double, but.
Well, what we're seeing here is a very different pattern for people who are participating compared to their organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we look at, I'll share the results, and that should be appearing, I'm trying to share the results. We see that that the highest one is that 17% of our audience has 100% of their personal work is focused on primary prevention. Another 14% is more than 75%, and that we have the smaller numbers for the lower ones. So that says that a lot about our audience, that our audience is very interested in primary prevention, while our organizations aren't necessarily focused
level.
Primarily, which is not necessarily a problem, but it just is something that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, well, it also says that we have the right audience for this dialogue today, because really, you know, folks are trying to do this work from within organizations that aren't as focused on it as they are, and that certainly brings with it, I think, some challenges that we'll get to,
mm-hmm.
But also, you know, I'm sure you'll all have a lot of solutions and advice that can help contribute to the field.
Well, flowing right from that, keeping those results in mind, that we want to ask one more question before we get into the bulk of this discussion. We'd like you to share with us right now some of the challenges that you've experienced trying to do primary prevention. And as we're collecting these, I'll give you just a minute, and then I'll start talking about some of the challenges that people submitted when they were registering.
So this is this one we want to encourage you to use your text chat function, and we see some folks are starting to do that.
Mm-hmm. Conservative community, funding, acceptance from public schools.
Focus on risk reduction, such as self-defense.
Mm.
Funding theme I'm seeing, and I'm seeing another theme of not enough time in schools.
And the person who wrote "there is no enter," if you can write a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Someone said getting more male leadership involved, something that we're going to explore today. Fears of others' loss of funding for victims to do prevention. Yeah, that's come up. Great. And while you keep, please keep text chatting, and I'm going to share some of the responses that came through with the registration questions. Funding, as you see, that's coming up again. Time, energy, and staff, not enough of either of those. A limited understanding of primary prevention and the primary prevention implications of intervention work. The immediate needs of direct service often take precedence over primary prevention. The attitude of we're already doing prevention and it works. Also, just resistance to change. And this is one that I found really interesting. Isolation from intervention staff, in particular in the separation of duties, whereas some staff are out doing community work and other staff are in-house doing in-house crisis hotline work. And that sets up a bit of a dichotomy and isolation there. Prevention work is also seen as too theoretical, and that also was related to prevention work being also too new. Lack of clear vision of the organization, and no evidence-based or outcome-driven processes in place to view local and cultural practices as prevention.
You know, I think that between, you know, the things you were just reading, Liz, that folks, you know, gave us ahead of time, and then also what people are typing in now, that this is just really, I think, important for the field to know and trying to support folks who are, you know, trying to do the work you're doing. The other thing that, you know, I think I saw in a couple places where people talked about fear, which relates to that funding thing, I think, and didn't necessarily come up in the things you talked about, Liz, but people are typing those in. And I think that that's something, as a whole field and a whole movement, we've got to get past. That this is not about taking another piece of a very small pie, but we really need to figure out how to make the pie bigger mm-hmm. so that we really have more resources to do all of this work in a significant way.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, as we've often said, too, the more work that we can move upstream, hopefully that will decrease the need for the incredible need that we have right now for victim services.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that this is kind of a helpful starting point now as we move into the panel. You know, I think I'm imagining these kinds of things are what's going to come up, and then we'll be able to open it up and hear more specifics from folks and also how people have really been dealing with mm-hmm. these kinds of challenges.
Great. Well, I really want to thank all of you for sharing with us just now and also for sharing your successes that we're going to talk about a little bit later on. So now we're going to move into our panel discussion, and I would like to introduce our four guest panelists today. We have with us Tina Fowler, who is the Outreach Coordinator for HOPE Incorporated of the West Virginia Rape Crisis Center. We have Larry McAdara and Sean Johnson. Larry is the Executive Director of the Riverside Area Rape Crisis Center, and Sean Johnson is the Director of the Operation Shelter, I'm getting that right, he will help us explain, a runaway shelter, and they're both co-facilitators of the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign. And we also have Pradipta Chapate of Chaya in Seattle, which provides domestic surveillance services to South Asian women in the Seattle area. Welcome to all four of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
Welcome. And it's nice to hear all your voices. Now we've gotten through that technical hurdle.
Yes.
We do have a little up in Seattle, you're having a little bit of technical problems, so you're not going to see Perdita's picture, but she is on the phone.
Yes. Right. All right. Well, we're going to start with Tina this morning. Hi, Tina.
Hello.
Hi. Could you start off by describing for us what your agency does, please?
Sure. HOPE Incorporated is a private, nonprofit United Way agency, and we serve both victims of domestic violence and sexual assault by providing emergency shelter and then a wide variety of services.
Great. Now, will you talk to us a little bit about how you're doing primary prevention within your organization?
Sure. We have a couple programs that we're real excited about. One of the programs, we have a local SART team, which is Sexual Assault Response Team, and we go into local high schools prior to prom, which also happens to be April, which is Sexual Assault Awareness Month.
Mm-hmm.
And our team consists of of course, from advocates from our agency, law enforcement, prosecutor, a SANE coordinator from our local hospital, and child protection service workers. Each member of the team goes into the schools for assembly in front of the whole student body, and we speak about drug-facilitated sexual assault. Each person talks about what it is, what are the consequences of sexual assault, what individuals can do to be safe when they go to the prom.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very impactful. Every time we go to the school, we always have people that stay afterwards and talk to us, a lot of times just sharing their experiences. One of the things that one of our detectives does is at the end of the presentation, we pass out cards, and we make sure everybody in the whole assembly receives the card, and it has all of our numbers. And he just lets them know, he's like, all of you have these cards, so if you see a friend who has a card, don't assume that something happened to him. You all have these cards. We want you all to put them in a safe place, and if you ever need anything, now you have a list of people to call or come see for help.
This is great. One of the questions that's come up a number of times has been the difficulty of getting into schools and getting into schools to do multiple sessions and just getting buy-in from school districts, school boards, school personnel. What do you think has been the key to your success in getting into this, not only getting into the schools, but getting into the schools for multiple sessions?
Well, and that's the other part of the program that we do is we do go into a school for a whole entire grading period, which is a six-week grading period, and we're in that school at least one day a week, every week during that period. We started that program here locally. We went to a person that I knew at the Board of Education, took the curriculum to him, let him look at it. They agreed to let us start with one pilot school, and we, you know, they welcomed us with open arms. We were there. The program was very successful. We were able to help with outcome measurement because we were able to do a pre- and post-test because we were in that school for such a long period of time. And then today we're in every middle school in our county.
Excellent. How many schools is that?
10.
Okay, excellent. Now, also, will you describe for me what's been the key to working with your partners? You have a really interesting team assembled.
You know, and our team has been strong and active for over 5 years, and we started just meeting as a SART team, and we've had a core group of people that attend every meeting. We meet once a month. They know, you know, we meet the third Wednesday of every month, so they know, you know, not to plan anything else for that date. They all come to the meetings, and then there came a time when we said, okay, you know, here we are. We're here to respond. We have an obligation to let the community know that we're here to respond, and what could we do to maybe prevent these rapes from happening to begin with? And that's when we talked about going into the schools and doing the pre-prom programs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you this. You know, I wanted you to share some of your successes, but first, will you describe for us some of the challenges that you face in promoting primary prevention in the way that you're doing?
I think one of the areas that's a big challenge here in West Virginia, and I'm sure in other states throughout the country, is West Virginia is a very rural state, and we have a lot of folks who would even like to come to our SART meetings or come do some of the primary prevention programs, but some of our communities only have perhaps maybe one law enforcement person, so they can't very well leave their duties as law enforcement personnel to come to a meeting. A lot of times transportation is difficult for us to get to some of the more rural areas within the state. Technology is another problem here because, you know, there's even parts of the area that do not offer internet service. Then you also have the folks who, if it is available, then maybe they don't have the resources to be able to get on the internet.
And how did you overcome these challenges?
Just trying to get the word out. We've even offered to maybe take some of our meetings to the more rural area so they don't have to come and, you know, each month we go to a different community to a different location instead of having it at the same place all the time. We'll try to go to different areas of the state for the meetings.
And Tina, will you please, before I move on, share with us some of your successes?
I think the pre-prom program is a success and getting into the schools on a consistent level. Now, before school starts, instead of us calling and asking the teachers if we can come in and do it, they're calling us and wanting to be the first ones to get our education specialist in so they can be sure that they have them throughout the school year.
Excellent. Great. Well, thank you. And we're going to come back to you. But right now, we're going to move on to our next panelist. And I'm going to let Rachel introduce this one.
Thanks. And I just want to say I think that there's some really important and insightful comments coming into the text chat. And when we're done with kind of all the panels, we're going to let folks ask some of those questions. So I think we can come back to some of those. But I just wanted to recognize that they're there. And I think that'll help add to the dialogue. So now we're going to turn our focus to and Liz, you're going to have to help me here. I'm sorry.
This is Pradeepta.
Pradeepta.
And I had the pleasure of working with Pradeepta and Chaya in Seattle back in March. Pradeepta Upathye. And great. There's the
Chaya logo. That sounds beautiful, that name. thanks. And thanks so much for joining us today. Can you tell us briefly what Chaya does?
Chaya is a community-based nonprofit organization here in Washington State. We are located in Seattle, and we work primarily with the South Asian community. So when I say South Asians, we're talking about people that draw their origins to any one of these seven countries, which is India, Nepal, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Bhutan. The focus of our work is community engagement, and direct services to South Asian survivors of domestic violence. I think, you know, I would like to mention that I think for a very long time we had focused mainly on providing direct services. But over the past few years, we began to realize that, you know, it was very, very important to be involved in prevention activities. And I'm really happy to share this with everybody that a year and a half ago, we adapted the spectrum of prevention model that the Prevention Institute in Oakland has. And that really helped us integrate all our activities and look upon the whole prevention issue as not only prevention in the terms of hoping that women would be safe, but also talking about prevention as an, in a more holistic way, as looking at the well-being of the entire South Asian community. So it's basically community engagement and direct services that we do.
So I think that that's, you know, what you're talking about is a really interesting transition to go from primarily service delivery only to really the full continuum. And can you talk a little bit about what was, you know, what some of the challenges might have been in doing that and how you engaged the entire agency really in moving into sort of a more balance along that continuum?
I think the challenges that we had to go through is integrating the staff. That was our number one challenge, because what we saw is that, you know, the staff that were doing direct services were just caught up in doing only direct services, and staff that were working in community engagement were doing only community engagement. And it felt like there was this disconnect within the organization. The other major issue also was, like, you know, we were really concerned about being a direct, a service-oriented organization without having a lot of advocacy and policy work being done. And something that really made us think about this even harder was looking at the immigration policies that our communities are going through right now and working with immigrant refugee groups predominantly. I mean, the people we work with are all immigrants and refugees. We began to realize that, you know, policy advocacy in so many ways is very crucial. Also, the other thing was looking at the mainstream organizations and how there seemed to be a kind of a disconnect to understand domestic violence in a South Asian context and the problems that our survivors were having when they were referred to shelters where they were completely not understood at all. And so we began to look around for a model that would help us integrate all these different activities and not only focus on either or. And it was at that point in time when I happened to find the spectrum of prevention model. And then we kind of went around and had a whole organizational change done where we integrated the staff. We said there should be no division in programs. The programs got integrated. So in the sense, like, if a staff is doing direct services and her time spent on that is 80%, we make sure that she has 20% to go out and do community engagement work as well. And that has really kind of, it's changed the very basics of the work that Chaya had been doing for so long. And I think in one way it has, I'll talk more about it when I talk about the successes, it has really strengthened our capacity for policy advocacy changes.
I think that's really helpful, because one of the challenges people noted was that there really seems to be a separation of staff within, you know, folks who are working on prevention or folks working on intervention. And it sounds like you had a lot of success in terms of trying to split up and integrate people together. So. I understand that you've got kind of an interesting partnership with an independent film production company.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that before?
Sure.
I also want to move into some of your successes as well. But
sure. You know, we have this organization here called Tasveer, which in the South Asian language means mirror, and they host the International South Asian Film Festival every once a year. And we help them sponsor that particular festival. And we have also started using it, not only just screening South Asian, really strong, powerful movies that are made in South Asia that project issues around women. We started using the space also as a space to talk about domestic violence and sexual assault. So this time what we did was we had this amazing event that Chaya developed, which is called Community Speaks. And we had a couple of women from the South Asian community who spoke about different issues in their lives that they had gone through and shared it with the audience. And that was amazing, because I think, you know, the communities that we come from, these are not issues that are very openly discussed, but it made us feel proud of the fact that it is possible to do that. And so with this year, we have this, we have a kind of a collaboration where we try to bring really powerful movies that have been developed around South Asian women's issues all over the world and have the international screening done here in Seattle. And that has really helped, I think, in attracting the South Asian community and also to some extent breaking the reluctance to talk about domestic violence that exists and break the sense of denial within the South Asian communities.
Great. Well, Pranita, before we get you to describe some of your successes, I want to ask you what have been some of the keys to success for you in terms of leveraging resources, financial or otherwise?
I think a major problem when we tried to integrate our programs was, to be very honest with all of you, is convincing the funders that, you know, community engagement was as equally important as direct services.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a reason why I think Chaya had always struggled, because somehow, you know, the feeling with the funding world is that, because when we talk about changing norms and behaviors and bringing about social change, it's always the feeling that, you know, it's a very slow process and it's very organic.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always, the response I got from the funders most of the time is that, but what are some of the tangible outcomes going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think trying to sit down with them and talk about how important it was, because, you know, it's very difficult to explain to the funders that there cannot be any social change if we do not look at it from a bottom-up approach. And the communities have to be engaged. They have to be constantly talking about violence within our communities to bring that bigger social change that's so required, apart from just focusing on direct services. So I think, honestly, the biggest challenge that we faced in having the integration done was being able to sit down with the funding, with the funders, and really explain to them why Chaya felt the need to kind of, you know, change and transition into this particular area now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within the organization, it was a kind of, it was a challenging situation too, because, you know, the organization had been so used to looking at these two programs separately and designing proposals very separately, you know, hiring staff in a very different way. So that's where the organizational changes had to happen. And all of us, the board and staff, had to be on the same page saying, this is a big transition for the organization, it's going to work. And it took us almost about 6 months to get the model, to get everybody on the same page and say, well, this is what we're going to be looking at now for the future of Chaya.
So you really, just like you integrated responsibilities of staff, you integrated the funding as well.
Yes. And I think funding was major, because, you know, I did hear a lot of comments about how most of the, right now in the conversation, how most of the organizations are very keen to, you know, start primary prevention. But it's a very different scenario when you seek funding. And especially when funding on domestic violence is so tight, it's always like, you know, show us what outcomes you have. What are your immediate outcomes? What are your tangible outcomes?
Mm-hmm.
And we all do know that, you know, when you're working on bringing changes within the community and talking about changing one's attitude, perception, knowledge, and behavior, these are very slow changes.
And it seems like that's probably one thing, too, that as a field we can start to do is together articulate those outcomes better, and maybe the theory of change of how they're connected long-term to outcomes, so that independently everyone's not having to do that.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What would you describe as the major successes or milestones you've had in terms of advancing the primary prevention agenda?
I think it has been in the field of community engagement, because we have a very specific program called the Peaceful Families, which is a program that we've geared towards the Muslim community in Washington State. And it's holding conferences and workshops within the Muslim community, open for men and women both, and talking about domestic violence in the context of the Quran, and trying to demystify the status of women as we see it being practiced today, as opposed to what the Quran explains and says about the status of women. And we've had that program now for about 3 years, and it has been one of our most successful programs. And I think every workshop that we've had significant participation from the men as well as the women. And for a couple of the workshops, we even had the religious leaders of the mosque come and participate in it. So it's that aspect of community engagement where we don't take programs only for women, but we try to include men participation as much as we can. The other thing that we've been doing a lot is holding community dialogues and community forums, again, opening it up to everybody. because I think we strongly believe that, you know, change cannot come without having men involved. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about domestic violence, many people just shut their doors saying, oh, this is a very radical movement and you're here to break families and that kind of thing. So we are very careful about approaching the communities with issues around immigration, health, and then building it up to domestic violence when we feel the community is accepting and open to talk about it. And that has worked really well. Very recently, we were able to conduct the first focus group that had ever been conducted in Seattle with the South Asian community. And it was interesting that we had seven groups, again, all community members. We had a group with the South Asian LGBT community. We had two groups with men only. And we had two groups with women only. And one was a mixed group between men and women. And going back to your question about the community engagement, I think it was really encouraging for us because most of the men that were in the men's groups said this is what we had been waiting for a long time. We were waiting for a forum like this where we could come and talk about domestic violence and violence within our communities. And they kind of, you know, asked us to keep continuing these forums if possible. So that was like, it helped us understand that the community is eager to get more information and that we were a little wrong when we talked about the sense of denial that we thought existed, which really didn't seem to be that way.
I have a lot of questions based on that, but I'm actually going to go for this next one here. Pradeepta, are there specific things that you think the field could do in the future to more strongly support individuals and organizations who are struggling to promote primary prevention?
I think going by the experience that Chaya had, Liz, to be honest with you, we struggled with it for a really long time. I think what was important was to be able to get a model that had been tried and tested and sit down with the funders and make them understand what was happening, right? So that was the first step. Like, you know, where can you get a model that integrates all these issues under the same umbrella mm-hmm. and moves the organization towards that level? That was something very, very important. And I think the next step then was also to some extent working very closely with mainstream organizations, and that has been something that China has been doing for a long time because, you know, we don't have a shelter, and all the survivors that we refer to have to go into shelters that are run by mainstream organizations. So I think it became very important for us to understand the mainstream organizations and for them to understand us and build very strong networks and collaborations that were sustainable.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And again, as I said, I'm going to open it up to questions just a little bit later. But right now I'm going to turn it over to Rachel and our last two guests.
Thanks, Liz. So Larry McAdara and Sean Johnson co-facilitate the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. And Larry's the executive director of the Riverside Area Rape Crisis Center. And Sean is the shelter director for Operation Safe House of the Desert, which provides services for runaways. So welcome, both of you.
And, thank you. Thank you.
Larry, can you please describe the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign and how you're doing primary prevention in partnership with the Rape Crisis Center?
Rachel, did you ask me, Larry, to answer that?
Yeah, is it better to ask Sean?
Yeah, I think it would be better to ask Sean, because Sean is the facilitator of the
Sean.
Strength campaign. I think he would probably be better suited to answer that particular
Great.
Part
well,
of it.
That's what I meant to do.
Yeah.
Hi, Sean.
Sean, do you want to talk a little bit about that, about the campaign and your partnership with the Rape Crisis Center?
My partnership with the Rape Crisis Center comes from the connection between the services that we provide in the city of or the county of Riverside, one being a teen crisis shelter and the other dealing with sexual assault prevention and other aspects of that. As far as the My Strength Club, it is a project where it deals with early prevention for teen boys ages 14 to 17. I'm going on my fourth year doing My Strength clubs here in Riverside. I do one in the city of Riverside, and I do another in the county in Beaumont, where the focus is really, really on prevention, and we kind of dive into stereotypes myths about masculinity. We talk about some of the language that we use. It's called the dominant story and the counter story, really things that we use about what are traditional norms for men, what is acceptable for men, what we learn from what we see as far as media, music, what society tells us, and we try to decipher what's good info and what isn't so good info.
Sean, let me ask you this. Because I know that you're working with runaways as well. And I want to know, from the work that you do, what's your experience in working with these young men? And in particular, what are some of the similarities and differences you see in the two types of groups that you work with in terms of runaways versus kids that you're working with in terms of issues of violence against women? And what are the broader community implications for the work that you're doing with both My Strength and Operation Safe House?
Well, the two are very similar because the young men that I work with in the My Strength campaign have similar family backgrounds and similar family dynamics and issues at home. And somehow or another, they are able to kind of stick with it and stay home. Their situation hasn't got to the point where they needed to run away. Whereas the kids that I deal with at Safe House, their situations have gotten to the point where they needed to run away. Another similarity is that, you know, the young people that I work with at Safe House still have the same general perceptions of sexual prevention, especially the young boys that I work with. Through Safe House, have the same kind of views about rape prevention, rape and sexual assault prevention, the kind of idea that the only way that that us as men can prevent rape is if we don't do it. So they share the same ideas that some of the teen boys that I work with in my strength clubs have shared. Now, as far as us on a larger scale, what I think the My Strength Club has done for the school is really been ambassadors for the schools to say that we have a program that has been well accepted, that I'll say that the young people think is cool. It's cool to be a part of this program at the school. So it creates an environment where the My Strength program is acceptable at the high school.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what we do at Safe House, we're still pretty new to the desert area. Our primary location has been in Riverside, where we've been up and going for going on 18 years. So the word is still getting out there about what we do in the community. And we have an outreach team that's been going out to the community, letting them know that we're here and what we provide. And our goal is to, you know, take youth off the streets, provide a safe haven for youth.
Mm-hmm.
That's the message that we try to spread to the community in general.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Sean. And Larry, I'm pretty sure this next question is for you. You know, we just heard from Perdita about how she was able to take their organization from a service delivery, primarily service treatment organization, to include primary prevention. And I understand that you've moved your organization significantly to primary prevention. So, you know, I'm curious, you know, why? Why did you feel the need to do that? And how did you accomplish that shift?
You know, one of the things I would have to say is I did it. It wasn't like unilaterally by any stretch of the imagination, but it basically began about 4 years ago with the board actually hiring me. Our organization has been in existence for 35 years now, and I'm the first male executive director that they've ever had. That was a huge step on the part of the board. And one of the things that I was able to do at the time of the interview was to talk about the fact that, yes, while we are talking about violence, preventing violence against women in many ways, it is really should not be a gender-specific issue. And because we had already in like a previous life of mine, we had already begun to see the shift of that paradigm where all of a sudden now direct services were now sort of starting that shift from just teaching women how to protect themselves and moving it into how to prevent it in the first place. And in order to get to that level of prevention, it requires, I think, the involvement, which has been echoed by, I think, both Tina and Pradeepta, to include men.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been a huge, huge tool for us and resource for us, because very candidly, when I go out and make community presentations, which I do a lot, people have a certain predisposition, and immediately I can command a certain level of attention simply because I'm not a woman. Most people expect the executive director of a rape crisis center to be a woman. So I at least can command a little bit of attention when I'm initially introduced. But one of the things that I try to do is explain to people as well that we are more than just direct services. And that leads me right into the strength campaign. The strength campaign, as David Lee, we were affiliated with CASA. We were one of six pilot sites in the state of California to be selected to do the strength campaign. And the strength campaign facilitated a minor shift in how we are framed in the community that created an enormous response. We were already doing prevention. We do prevention. We have approved curriculum through both of our school districts, the Riverside Unified School District and the Riverside County Office of Education, for primary, middle, high school, as well as college. We're out there doing the prevention all along. But I have not received nearly as many calls about those prevention programs as I have about the strength campaign, with schools wanting the strength campaign in their schools. And what it does is it proactively engages young men in behavior that prevents violence against women. And it does it in a very, very proactive way. And again, going back to a leadership conference that I just attended up in Sacramento at Cal CASA, we had a man speak. His name is Mark Manis. And one of the things that I was really enthralled with was the way he was able to articulate the prevention continuum. And those of us that are involved in prevention, at one end of the continuum is the discussion of risky behavior. And at the other end of the continuum is the introduction of positive behavior and or what he refers to as asset building. And basically, both are almost saying the same things. However, when you get into the positive behavior reinforcement or creation of that positive behavior, if you will, using his asset, I think there were 40 or 41 asset building attributes to the program, you are essentially saying the same thing in a very user-friendly way, because a number of the things that we are confronted with are the same things that I think most direct service providers are encounter from school districts and various other things, and that is a real concern about what are your programs going to present,
mm-hmm.
Are you going to be doing shock talk, that type of thing. Rather than just the prevention aspect. But the reception of the strength campaign has also, ironically enough, one of the interesting things in talking to Liz and other people even earlier, one of the major things, and this may be a question that you were going to ask me later, but as far as one of the roadblocks to primary prevention is, again, outcome measurement. That's one thing that I deal with all the time. But interestingly enough, our community has responded so positively to the strength campaign that normally what the question is what is it? Once it's explained, it stops short of asking me what the outcome measurements of that are, because people are so taken with the fact that it is engaging men in this particular movement.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was really I have to say that just, you know, talking with you, I suspect that just part of your, you know, enthusiasm about this is probably has something to do with how you've, you know, been able to kind of move this forward, because it's really kind of infectious almost. But I was curious because, you know, you said it started because the board made a different decision. And I've had a lot of people say to me, you know, that's not where our board is at. How do I get to our board? Or that's not where my executive director's at.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get them there? And I'm curious what advice you have for people who are, you know, trying to really expand the continuum within their organization to make the case for leadership, and we're to make the case to leadership to do more of this. And clearly we're hearing the outcome measure stuff is an issue. We're hearing having frameworks help. But what advice would you give to those folks?
I think, again, going back to what again, Mark Manis was talking about, is going towards, on the prevention continuum, going towards the positive behavior types of things. It was like when I was talking to Liz earlier, I said one of the things that we're planning to do in the future is we're trying to put together a program that and this is a huge oversimplification, but that would actually, something that you would hand somebody is something that they could hang on a refrigerator or whatever, and it would be a list of do's rather than don'ts. And oftentimes it's like, for instance, there are people on our board that are very, very concerned about the delivery of direct services, which is where a lot of our emphasis goes. But in addition to that, we have a number of people, and I think this speaks to your board makeup as well. We have a number of people that are from our district attorney's office. We have a number of people that are from law enforcement. All types of people that are looking to prevent the types of things that they are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I'm sure across the country, I would probably pretty much be, probably pretty much be sure that the numbers are not going down dramatically. And that's one of the things. And sometimes you do have to be sort of subtle. I know with our board, again, the initial interview that we had, that the major question was, how was I going to, as a man, address these issues? And so I knew that there was already a predisposition to change.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm conscious of the time, and I want to give you a chance, Sean, to just weigh in terms of what you think might be needed to advance primary prevention efforts within service delivery organizations. And in a minute, we're going to open it up for people to ask questions or make comments and kind of just open up the whole conversation. So, Sean, do you have any final thoughts about how to move this primary prevention agenda?
You know, I was talking with Larry before we started. And I think from us on a from what the Rape Crisis Center has been able to do, I think we've done a good job with getting the word out there and really promoting this program. And I even think the schools that we've been connected with, I've been fortunate to have really good success with the schools and really good support from the schools. But I would like to see even more work done in the schools. I would like, you know, we talked about my time with my groups are really short. You know, we're talking, 40 to 45 minutes, and even in trying to introduce this as part of curriculum in the schools. You know, those are the type of things that I personally would like to see happen. But fortunately, I've had really good success at both of the schools and really good support from Larry here at the Rape Crisis Center and the school counselors, the principals, and teachers.
So, I mean, it's just, I think, another example, and we heard that from some of our other panelists, too, about the importance of partnerships and really working with partners who, are part of the prevention partners in advancing this. And so I want to thank actually all of you. And because we are running a little behind, and I do want to make sure we have a chance to open up, I'm sort of going to take moderator's prerogative here. And I'm going to ask the whole panel one question that's actually for all of you to answer through text chat, too. And if any of you want to make comments, on your phone lines, you can go ahead and raise your hand now, and we'll call on you.
Comments, or if you have questions for our panelists.
Or questions, exactly. Thanks, Liz. And while you're text chatting in or raising your hand, let me just put out this question, which has sort of been plaguing me as we've been thinking about this particular forum, is I'm wondering if you think there's any inherent conflict in this kind of current system, which is putting prevention funding through the service delivery mechanism? You know, and if so, what is that conflict? Or, you know, does it make sense in terms of the models we've been hearing today to really look at better integration? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just curious what people's thoughts are about that. And panelists, if you want to start, and then if anybody wants to talk, feel free to raise your hand and we can get your phone line opened.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm gonna just pick on somebody right now while we're getting responses from our audiences. Pradeepta,
mm-hmm.
Do you see any, I mean, because funding is one of the things that you talked about, do you see any conflict, as Rachel just asked, in putting prevention money through service delivery organizations? Or do you think that's the way to go?
It's an interesting question because, you know, that's, I think, something that I struggled with for a really long time. Because very often, you know, when you get RFPs or call for RFPs, it says a shelter, an organization that has a shelter, or a shelter-run organization is only eligible to apply. So when you look at the way the funding sources are designated from the very beginning, I do agree. It's difficult for an organization to say where do you put the money. Would you rather divert it towards direct services, or would you rather focus on primary prevention? But I think it's something that we have to be able to challenge the funders with and really be able to make them understand that, you know, as an organization that believes in social change and social justice, that's what I did with China, mm-hmm. is that, you know, we just have to look at both components as being equally important to the work that we are doing.
Okay.
And, I think we've been pretty successful because I would want to share it with everybody that, you know, once we kind of integrated the programs and we adapted the spectrum of prevention model, it really helped us to have a tool to sit with the funders and talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I think till that time it was more like, okay, how do we put our case forward and say that this is the position we are in and this is what we want to pursue? But it helped us a lot when, you know, we had a tool in front of us.
Thanks. I want to ask if we could have Dixie Allen's phone line opened up. And while that's happening, it does seem like there's a lot of comments about that some of what makes sense in terms of the integration has to do with the community engagement, community building aspect of this, and that it might not make sense to separate that out at all. And that, of course, there's also the existing capacity within those organizations and that knowledge base. So if folks have other thoughts, you know, raise your hand and we'll call on you, or also you can text chat it in. But did we get Dig line open?
This is David. Just, I think Kat Fribley points out in the text chat the issue of that sometimes you can't separate them out and that there sometimes are other issues that come up. So, you know, disclosures and things of that nature. So we need to be attentive to that.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Ms. Allen, your line is now open.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Dixie.
Hi. Well, sometimes I wonder if the conflict between delivery of services and prevention of violence in terms of funding might be problematic. And I don't want to step on anyone's toes. I've worked in shelters for a long time, and now I'm at a university. But in terms of we have these numbers that we have to justify as far as the number of beds that are filled, the number of clients that we're seeing. And if you stop and say, well, we want to actually prevent this, would we be putting ourselves out of a job? And we say that we want to put ourselves out of a job, but do we really want to put ourselves out of a job? And that's a question that I think we have to be honest in asking. And, you know, is that a conflict?
So, you know, I think that's an interesting question, and I'd kind of like to put that out to all of you, you know, but panelists and, you know, and the rest of the audience of, do you think that that's kind of an issue?
Rachel, this is Larry at the Riverside Area Rape Crisis Center. One of the things that I see with that is, I do not see a huge conflict with that, because we talk about that quite a bit in our volunteer training, that eventually what we're trying to work towards is where we are not really needed in the capacity of direct services delivery. However, my concept of the whole thing is that if you are able to bring those numbers down, then what your services are going to do is there's going to be a shift to the prevention aspect of it, and that prevention aspect of the services that are being delivered are what are going to sustain the lowering of the frequency of those events.
So that we see a shifting from focus in intervention and treatment and services to prevention.
Exactly, exactly. And it's those efforts that have brought down those numbers, and those mm-hmm. efforts need to be sustained for those numbers to continue to decrease.
Hello?
Excitement in the background.
Oh, is that
there?
Excitement?
Oh.
Sorry, that I just forgot completely what I was going to say. But, you know, I do think it's important to be explicit about that, because sometimes I think that when prevention is working, that then we forget that it's needed and stop
exactly.
focusing on it. So the notion that we're being explicit that as numbers are going down, we really need to keep the investment in prevention so that we don't see the numbers go back up makes a lot of sense to me.
Right.
And I saw Wendy Loomis's comment that you want to work yourself out of a job. I feel like I have a similar perspective.
One of the things, though, that I do have to acknowledge, though, is the fact that, you know, being very aware of, like, our collaboration with Operation Safe House, both here in Riverside and out in the desert, is that I can understand the challenge of bed nights, of those types of issues that keep that funding coming. And I can imagine that the challenge to shelters are much different than the challenges to the type of direct services that we deliver as a rape crisis center. So I don't mean to just simply say, well, you know, you just need to make that paradigm shift from, you know, from delivering service to prevention. But I know there's got to be that gradual thing to where we do, and I think, Rachel, I think it was just you that said it more eloquently than I, and that's the fact that we need to do that to sustain the lowering of those numbers.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you know what I'm thinking might make sense, because we do have a couple more minutes right now. Maybe we could go back to those challenges slides that we had up. And I'd love to hear from more of you about the kinds of things you've done to overcome those challenges, because I think that will be helpful for everyone who's participating today.
Mm-hmm. And while we're pulling those up, Pradeep said there was a specific question for you in the text chat. Noel Duffler, could you describe for us the organizational model that you use to accomplish primary prevention?
The organizational model that we used for
yes.
primary prevention?
Yes.
I didn't quite understand the question, Liz. Could you just...
Yeah, and I'm trying to pull it up in text chat here, too.
Okay.
And I wonder, because I know you mentioned using the spectrum of prevention as a framework to integrate things, I'm wondering
right.
if that might have been what...
I mean, you know, the whole integration started as a result of us wanting to adapt the spectrum of prevention.
But is that a problem, though?
Sorry, I think we interrupted you, Pradeepta.
So I think there were a couple of things. It was basically us wanting to adapt the spectrum of prevention on one side, and the other thing was also trying to figure out, like, you know, as a community-based organization, we had to be careful that, you know, for the many years that China's been around and for many more years that we may be, what is it that we want to do with our communities and bring kind of, you know, make sure that tomorrow, if the organization is not around, domestic violence should not be an issue that they cannot deal with. And I think looking at that, what we thought very important was prevention, primary prevention and awareness was crucial, because, you know, the community has to be held responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be able to take on violence against women as something that is an issue within the community and own responsibility for what's happening and not have an depend on an organization, because as a nonprofit, you know, we are all very fragile and it depends on the funding scenario that we are in. So the long-term outcome for China then was to figure out and say, what is the impact that we can leave behind for our communities, and how do we make our communities more accountable and responsible to take on violence against women issues as something which they need to be own, there has to be a kind of an ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the spectrum of prevention model, and this, I would say, hunger to hold a community accountable and responsible that we used at the, as the basis of the organizational changes that we made in focusing on primary prevention as an equally important part of the work that we do, and not only direct services. And we knew for the longest time that, you know, the challenge would be funding.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something we said, well, we just have to deal with it and see how it goes.
Perfect. Thank you. And thanks, Nicole, for Noelle, for clarifying the question. And it was about community engagement and how you did that, Pradita. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. It looks like I've noticed a couple people are starting to have written in some of the ways they've overcome challenges. That's great. You know, we'll have an archive of this text chat at Prevention Connection website. I want to thank all of you for participating today, and particularly thank our panelists. And I'll just, you know, say before I turn it over to Liz for the the final say that a number of the themes I heard today had to do with integration of staff along the continuum, partnerships, making this really something that others want, you know, that the other partners are really excited, that we need to get some more concrete outcome measures on the primary prevention side, and that community capacity and community engagement is really a piece that transcends all of this and something to build on. So, so thank you, everyone, and Liz.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to add, yes, exactly, the community engagement piece really stood out for me throughout these discussions, and the importance of getting the community engaged in order to get the broader policy changes in place, and also ways to bring leadership on board and the crucial aspect that that plays in moving primary prevention from the margins to the center. And I just want to thank once again all of our guest panelists, Tina, Larry, Sean, Pradita. Thank you for joining us, and thank our guest audience. And I'm going to turn it over to David now for the evaluation.
Okay, you should see on your screen an evaluation. If you don't see an evaluation, we will email you a link to that immediately following the web conference, so you can be able to do it that way. I just want that we will post on the Prevent Connect listserv the archive, the text chat, and of the slides are here. We are going to see about if we can get a recording. We've had a little bit of technical pieces with that. And there's a lot of people who are asking for resources, so we will include those resources in the text chat section, because a lot of people want to know where to find curriculums and how to be able to connect with people. And many people were sharing their resources. Once again, this is a discussion that feels like it is only the beginning of a conversation. And what we're trying to do at Prevention Connection is being a place to have that discussion and at least start that conversation and support you in doing more of those discussions. So we will be continuing to have more web conferences to explore these issues, look at the Reading Club and the Listserv and other places to continue that. And so that's our goal, is to be able to help this discussion, because that's how we're going to advance violence against women prevention. So we will have the evaluation on the screen. If you have a problem with it, you will get an email once when we close the session out, and to do the evaluation, so you can be able to do that. And I just want to thank Rachel and Liz and the other people here, Sam and the other people from Prevention Institute behind the scenes, and all of our speakers who joined us, and all of you for joining us. So thank you very much for this. Can the speakers please stay on the line? Because we will be having a little sub-conference, and this will conclude the audio portion of our conference. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. This concludes the CalCASA conference call. Thank you, everyone, for joining. You may now disconnect.